in this hotel. Hell, I'm with the district attorney's conference. I've already paid for my room. Sorry, sir, you're on the late list. Your reservations were transferred to the, Moonlight Motel, which is out on Paradise Boulevard and actually a very fine place of lodging, and only 16 blocks from here, with its own pool and...
You dirty little faggot! Call the manager! I'm tired of listening to this dog shit!
The manager appeared and offered to call a cab. This was obviously the second or maybe even the third act in a cruel drama that had begun long before I showed up. The police chief's wife was crying. The gaggle of friends that he'd mustered for support were too embarrassed to back him up. Even now, in this showdown at the desk, with this angry little cop firing his best and final shot, they knew he was beaten. He was going against the rules, and the people hired to enforce those rules said, no vacancy. After 10 minutes of standing in line behind this noisy little asshole and his friends, I felt the bile rising. Where did this cop, of all people, get the nerve to argue with anybody in terms of right and reason? I had been there with these fuzzy little shitheads, and so, I sensed, had the desk clerk. He had the air of a man who'd been fucked around in his time by a fairly good cross-section of mean-tempered, rule-crazy cops. So now he was just giving their argument back to them. It doesn't matter who's right or wrong, man, or who's paid his bill and who hasn't. What matters right now is that for the first time in my life I can work out on a pig. Fuck you, officer. I'm in charge here, and I'm telling you we don't have room for you. I was enjoying this whip song, but after a while I felt dizzy, bad, nervous, and my impatience got the better of my amusement. So I stepped around the pig and spoke directly to the desk clerk. Say, I said, I hate to interrupt, but I have a reservation, and I wonder if maybe I could just sort of slide through and get out of your way. I smiled, letting him know I'd been digging his snake bully act on the cop party that was now standing there, psychologically off balance, and staring at me like I was some kind of water rat crawling up to the desk. I looked pretty bad, wearing old Levi's and white Chuck Taylor All-Star basketball sneakers, and my 10-peso Acapulco shirt had long since come apart at the shoulder seams from all that road wind. My beard was about 3 days old, bordering on standard wino trim, and my eyes were totally hidden by Sandy Bull's Saigon mirror shades. But my voice had the tone of a man who knows he has a reservation. I was gambling on my attorney's foresight, but I couldn't pass a chance to put the horn into a cop. And I was right. The reservation was in my attorney's name. The desk clerk hit his bell to summon the bag boy. This is all I have with me right now, I said. The rest is out there in that white Cadillac convertible. I pointed to the car that we could all see parked just outside the front door. Can you have somebody drive it around to the room? The desk clerk was friendly. Don't worry about a thing, sir. Just enjoy your stay here, and if there's anything you need, just call the desk. I nodded and smiled, half watching the stunned reaction of the cop crowd right next to me. They were stupid with shock. Here they were arguing with every piece of leverage they could command for a room they'd already paid for. And suddenly their whole act gets sideswiped by some crusty drifter who looks like something out of an upper Michigan hobo jungle. And he checks in with a handful of credit cards. Jesus! What's happening in this world? Three. Savage Lucy. Teeth like baseballs. Eyes like jellied fire. I gave my bag to the boy who scurried up and told him to bring a quart of wild turkey and 2/5 of Bacardi Añejo with a night's worth of ice. Our room was in one of the farthest wings of the Flamingo. The place is far more than a hotel. It is a sort of huge, underfinanced playboy club in the middle of the desert. Something like 9 separate wings with interconnecting causeways and pools. A vast complex sliced up by a maze of car ramps and driveways. It took me about 20 minutes to wander from the desk to the distant wing we'd been assigned to. My idea was to get into the room, accept the booze and baggage delivery, then smoke my last big chunk of Singapore Grey while watching Walter Cronkite and waiting for my attorney to arrive. I needed this break, this moment of peace and refuge, before we did the drug conference. It was going to be quite a different thing from the Mint 400. That had been an observer gig, but this one would need participation and a very special stance. At the Mint 400, we were dealing with an essentially simpatico crowd, and if our behavior was gross and outrageous, well, it was only a matter of degree. But this time, our very presence would be an outrage. We would be attending the conference under false pretenses and dealing, from the start, with a crowd that was convened for the stated purpose of putting people like us in jail. We were the menace, not in disguise, but stone-obvious drug abusers, with a flagrantly cranked-up act that we intended to push all the way to the limit. Not to prove any final sociological point, and not even as a conscious mockery. It was mainly a matter of lifestyle, a sense of obligation and even duty. If the pigs were gathering in Vegas for a top-level drug conference, we felt the drug culture should be represented. Beyond that, I'd been out of my head for so long now that a gig like this seemed perfectly logical. Considering the circumstances, I felt totally meshed with my karma. Or at least I was feeling this way until I got to the big gray door that opened into Mini Suite 1150 in the far wing. I rammed my key into the knob lock and swung the door open, thinking, ah, home at last. But the door hit something, which I recognized at once as a human form, a girl of indeterminate age with the face and form of a pit bull. She was wearing a shapeless blue smock, and her eyes were angry. Somehow I knew that I had the right room. I wanted to think otherwise, but the vibes were hopelessly right. And she seemed to know, too, because she made no move to stop me when I moved past her and into the suite. I tossed my leather satchel on one of the beds and looked around for what I knew I would see. My attorney, stark naked, standing in the bathroom door with a drug-addled grin on his face. "You degenerate pig," I muttered. "It can't be helped," he said, nodding at the bulldog girl. "This is Lucy," he laughed distractedly. "You know, like Lucy in the sky with diamonds." I nodded to Lucy, who was eyeing me with definite venom. I was clearly some kind of enemy, some ugly intrusion on her scene, and it was clear from the way she moved around the room, very quick and tense on her feet, that she was sizing me up. She was ready for violence. There was not much doubt about that. Even my attorney picked up on it. "Lucy," he snapped. "Lucy, be cool, goddammit. Remember what happened at the airport. No more of that, okay?" He smiled nervously at her. She had the look of a beast that had just been tossed into a sawdust pit to fight for its life. "Lucy, this is my client. This is Mr. Duke, the famous journalist. He's paying for this suite, Lucy. He's on our side." She said nothing. I could see that she was not entirely in control of herself. Huge shoulders on the woman, and a chin like Oscar Bonavena. I sat down on the bed and casually reached into my satchel for the mace can. And when I felt my thumb on the shoot button, I was tempted to jerk the thing out and soak her down on general principles. I desperately needed peace, rest, sanctuary. The last thing I wanted was a fight to the finish in my own hotel room with some kind of drug-crazed hormone monster. My attorney seemed to understand this. He knew why my hand was in the satchel. "No," he shouted. "Not here. We'll have to move out." I shrugged. He was twisted, I could see that. And so was Lucy. Her eyes were feverish and crazy. She was staring at me like I was something that would have to be rendered helpless before life could get back to whatever she considered normal. My attorney idled over and put his arm around her shoulders. "Mr. Duke is my friend," he said gently. "He loves artists. Let's show him your paintings." For the first time, I noticed that the room was full of artwork. Maybe 40 or 50 portraits, some in oil, some charcoal, all more or less the same size and all the same face. They were propped up on every flat surface. The face was vaguely familiar, but I couldn't get a fix on it. It was a girl with a broad mouth, a big nose, and extremely glittering eyes. A demoniacally sensual face. The kind of overstated, embarrassingly dramatic renderings that you find in the bedrooms of young female art students who get hung up on horses. "Lucy paints portraits of Barbara Streisand," my attorney explained. "She's an artist up in Montana." He turned to the girl. "What's that town where you live?" She stared at him, then at me, then back at my attorney again. Then finally she said, "Kalispell. Way up north. I drew these from TV. My attorney nodded eagerly. "Fantastic," he said. "She came all the way down here just to give all these portraits to Barbara. We're going over to the Americana Hotel tonight and meet her backstage." Lucy smiled bashfully. There was no more hostility in her. I dropped the mace can and stood up. We obviously had a serious case on our hands. I hadn't counted on this. Finding my attorney whacked on acid and locked into some kind of preternatural courtship. "Well," I said, "I guess they've brought the car around by now. Let's get the stuff out of the trunk." He nodded eagerly. "Absolutely, let's get the stuff." He smiled at Lucy. "We'll be right back. Don't answer the phone if it rings." She grinned and made the one-fingered Jesus freak sign. "God bless," she said. My attorney pulled on a pair of elephant leg pants and a glazed black shirt. Then we hurried out of the room. I could see he was having trouble getting oriented, but I refused to humor him. "Well," I said, "what are your plans?" "Plans?" We were waiting for the elevator. "Lucy," I said. He shook his head, struggling to focus on the question. "Shit," he said finally. "I met her on the plane, and I had all that acid," he shrugged. "You know, those little blue barrels? Jesus, she's a religious freak. She's running away from home for something like the fifth time in 6 months. It's terrible. I gave her that cap before I realized, shit, she's never even had a drink." "Well," I said, "it'll probably work out. We can keep her loaded and peddle her ass at the drug convention." He stared at me. "She's perfect for this gig," I said. "These cops will go $50 ahead to beat her into submission and then gang fuck her. We can set her up in one of these back street motels, hang pictures of Jesus all over the room, then turn these pigs loose on her. Hell, she's strong. She'll hold her own." His face was twitching badly. We were in the elevator now, descending into the lobby. "Jesus Christ," he muttered. "I knew you were sick, but I never expected to hear you actually say that kind of stuff." He seemed stunned. I laughed. "It's straight economics. This girl is a godsend." I fixed him with a natural Bogart smile, all teeth. "Shit, we're almost broke. And suddenly you pick up some muscle-bound loony who can make us a grand a day." "No," he shouted. "Stop talking like that." The elevator door opened and we walked toward the parking lot. "I figure she can do about 4 at a time," I said. "Christ, if we keep her full of acid, that's more like 2 grand a day, maybe 3. "You filthy bastard," he sputtered. "I should cave your fucking head in." He was squinting at me, shielding his eyes from the sun. I spotted the whale about 50 feet from the door. "There it is," I said. Not a bad-looking car, for a pimp. He groaned. His face reflected the struggle that I knew he was having, in his brain, with sporadic acid rushes. Bad waves of painful intensity, followed by total confusion. When I opened the trunk of the Whale to get the bags, he got angry.
What the hell are you doing? He snapped. This isn't Lucy's car.
I know, I said. It's mine. This is my luggage.
The fuck it is, he shouted. Just because I'm a goddamn lawyer doesn't mean you can walk around stealing stuff right in front of me.
He backed away.
What the hell is wrong with you? We'll never beat a rap like this.
After much difficulty, we got back to the room and tried to have a serious talk with Lucy. I felt like a Nazi, but it had to be done. She was not right for us, not in this fragile situation. It was bad enough if she were only what she appeared to be, a strange young girl in the throes of a bad psychotic episode. But what worried me far more than that was the likelihood that she would probably be just sane enough in a few hours to work herself into a towering Jesus-based rage at the hazy recollection of being picked up and seduced in the Los Angeles International Airport by some kind of cruel Samoan who fed her liquor and LSD, then dragged her to a Vegas hotel room and savagely penetrated every orifice in her body with his throbbing, uncircumcised member. I had a terrible vision of Lucy crashing into Barbara Streisand's dressing room at the Americana and laying this brutal story on her. That would finish us. They would track us down and probably castrate us both prior to booking. I explained this to my attorney, who was now in tears at the idea of sending Lucy away. She was still powerfully twisted, and I felt the only solution was to get her as far as possible from the Flamingo before she got straight enough to remember where she'd been and what happened to her. Lucy, while we argued, was lying on the patio doing a charcoal sketch of Barbara Streisand, from memory this time. It was a full-faced rendering, with teeth like baseballs and eyes like jellied fire. The sheer intensity of the thing made me nervous. This girl was a walking bomb. God only knows what she might be doing with all that miswired energy right now if she didn't have her sketch pad. And what was she gonna do when she got straight enough to read the Vegas Visitor, as I just had, and learned that Streisand wasn't due at the Americana for another 3 weeks. My attorney finally agreed that Lucy would have to go. The possibility of a Mann Act conviction, resulting in disbarment proceedings and total loss of his livelihood, was a key factor in his decision. A nasty federal rap, especially for a monster Samoan facing a typical white middle-class jury in Southern California. They might even call it kidnapping, I said. Straight to the gas chamber like chessmen. And even if you manage to beat that, they'll send you back to Nevada for rape and consensual sodomy.
No, he shouted. I felt sorry for the girl. I wanted to help her.
I smiled. That's what Fatty Arbuckle said. And you know what they did to him.
Who?
Never mind, I said. Just picture yourself telling a jury that you tried to help this poor girl by giving her LSD and then taking her out to Vegas for one of your special stark-naked back rubs. He shook his head sadly.
You're right. They'd probably burn me at the goddamn stake. Set me on fire right there in the dock. Shit. It doesn't pay to try to help somebody these days.
We coaxed Lucy down to the car, telling her that we thought it was about time to go meet Barbara. We had no trouble convincing her that she should take all her artwork, but she couldn't understand why my attorney wanted to bring her suitcase along. I don't want to embarrass her, she protested. She'll think I'm trying to move in with her or something. No, she won't, I said quickly. But that was all I could think of to say. I felt like Martin Bormann. What would happen to this poor wretch when we cut her loose? Jail? White slavery? What would Dr. Darwin do under these circumstances? Survival of the fittest? Is that the proper word? Had Darwin ever considered the idea of temporary unfitness, like temporary insanity? Could the doctor have made room in his theory for a thing like LSD? All this was academic, of course. Lucy was a potentially fatal millstone on both our necks. There was absolutely no choice but to cut her adrift and hope her memory was fucked. But some acid victims, especially nervous mongoloids, have a strange kind of idiot savant capacity for remembering odd details and nothing else. It was possible that Lucy might spend two or more days in the grip of total amnesia, then snap out of it with no memory of anything but our room number at the Flamingo. I thought about this, but the only alternative was to take her out to the deserts and feed her remains to the lizards. I wasn't ready for this. It seemed a bit heavy for the thing we were trying to protect, my attorney. It came down to that. So the problem was to work out a balance, to aim Lucy in a direction that wouldn't snap her mind and provoke a disastrous backlash. She had money. My attorney had ascertained that. At least $200, he'd said, and we can always call the cops up there in Montana where she lives and turn her in. I was reluctant to do this. The only thing worse than turning her loose in Vegas, I felt, was turning her over to the authorities. And that was clearly out of the question anyway. Not now. What kind of goddamn monster are you? I said. First you kidnap the girl, then you rape her, and now you want to have her locked up. He shrugged. It just occurred to me, he said, that she has no witnesses. Anything she says about us is completely worthless. Us, I said. He stared at me. I could see that his head was clearing. The acid was almost gone. This meant that Lucy was probably coming down, too. It was time to cut the cord. Lucy was waiting for us in the car, listening to the radio with a twisted smile on her face. We were standing about 10 yards off. Anybody watching us from a distance might have thought we were having some kind of vicious showdown argument about who had rights to the girl. It was a standard scene for a Vegas parking lot. We finally decided to make her a reservation at the Americana. My attorney ambled over to the car and got her last name under some pretense. Then I hurried inside and called the hotel, saying that I was her uncle and that I wanted her to be treated very gently because she was an artist and might seem a trifle high-strung. The room clerk assured me they'd give her every courtesy. Then we drove her out to the airport, saying we were going to trade the white whale in for a Mercedes 600, and my attorney took her into the lobby with all her gear. She was still unhinged and babbling when he led her away. I drove around a corner and waited for him. 10 minutes later, he shuffled up to the car and got in. Take off slowly, he said. Don't attract any attention. When we got out on Las Vegas Boulevard, he explained that he'd given one of the airport cab hasslers a $10 bill to see that his drunk girlfriend got to the Americana, where she had a reservation. I told him to make sure she got there, he said. You think she will? He nodded. The guy said he'd pay the fare with the extra $5 I gave him and tell the cabbie to humor her. I told him I had some business to take care of, but I'd be there myself in an hour, and if the girl wasn't already checked in, I'd come back out here and rip his lungs out. That's good, I said. You can't be subtle in this town. He grinned. As your attorney, I advise you to tell me where you put the goddamn mescaline. I pulled over. The kit bag was in the trunk. He fetched out 2 pellets, and we each ate one. The sun was going down behind the scrub hills northwest of the city. A good Christofferson tune was croaking out of the radio. We cruised back to town through the warm dusk, relaxed on the red leather seats of our electric white Coupe de Ville. Maybe we should take it easy tonight, I said, as we flashed past the Tropicana. Right, he said. Let's find a good seafood restaurant and eat some red salmon. I feel a powerful lust for red salmon. I agreed. But first we should go back to the hotel and settle in. Maybe have a quick swim and some rum. He nodded, leaning back on the seat and staring up at the sky. Night was coming down slowly. Four. No refuge for degenerates. Reflections on a murderous junkie. We drove through the parking lot of the Flamingo and around the back, through the labyrinth, to our wing. No problem with parking, no problem with the elevator, and the suite was dead quiet when we entered. Half dark and peacefully elegant, with big sliding walls opening out on the lawn and the pool. The only thing moving in the room was the red blinking message light on the telephone. Probably room service, I said. I ordered some ice and booze. I guess it came while we were gone. My attorney shrugged. We have plenty, he said, but we might as well get more. Hell yes, tell him to send it up. I picked up the phone and dialed the desk. What's the message? I asked. My light is blinking. The clerk seemed to hesitate. I could hear papers shuffling. Ah, yes, he said finally. Mr. Duke? Yes, you have two messages. One says, Welcome to Las Vegas from the National District Attorneys Association. Wonderful, I said. And the other, he continued, says, Call Lucy at the Americana Room 1600. What? He repeated the message. There was no mistake. Holy shit, I muttered. Excuse me, said the clerk. I hung up. My attorney was doing the big spit again in the bathroom. I walked out on the balcony and stared at the pool, this kidney-shaped bag of bright water that shimmered outside our suite. I felt like Othello. Here I'd only been in town a few hours and we'd already laid the groundwork for a classic tragedy. The hero was doomed. He had already sown the seed of his own downfall. But who was the hero of this filthy drama? I turned away from the pool and confronted my attorney, now emerging from the bathroom and wiping his mouth with a towel. His eyes were glazed and limpid. This goddamn mescaline, he muttered. Why the fuck can't they make it a little less pure? Maybe mix it up with Rolaids or something. Othello used Dramamine, I said. He nodded, hanging the towel around his neck as he reached out to flip on the TV set. Yeah, I heard about those remedies. Your man Fatty Arbuckle used olive oil. Lucy called, I said. What? He sagged visibly, like an animal taking a bullet. I just got a message from the desk. She's at the Americana, room 1600, and she wants us to call. He stared at me. And just then the phone rang. I shrugged and picked it up. There was no point trying to hide. She had found us, and that was enough. Hello, I said. It was the room clerk again. Mr. Duke? Yes. Hello, Mr. Duke. I'm sorry we were cut off a moment ago, but I thought I should call again, because I was wondering... What? I sensed things closing down on us. This fucker was about to spring something on me. What had that crazy bitch said to him? I tried to stay calm. We're watching the goddamn news, I screamed. What the fuck are you interrupting me for? Silence. What do you want? Where's the goddamn ice I ordered? Where's the booze? There's a war on, man. People are being killed. Killed? He almost whispered the word. In Vietnam, I yelled. On the goddamn television! Oh, yes, yes, he said. This terrible war. When will it end? Tell me, I said quietly. What do you want? Of course, he said, snapping back to his desk clerk tone. I thought I should tell you, because I know you're here with the police convention. that the woman who left that message for you sounded very disturbed. He hesitated, but I said nothing. I thought you should know this, he said finally. What did you say to her? I asked.
Nothing, nothing at all, Mr. Duke. I merely took the message.
He paused. But it wasn't that easy, talking to that woman. She was, well, extremely nervous. I think she was crying.
Crying?
My brain had locked up. I couldn't think. The drug was taking over.
Why was she crying?
Well, she didn't say, Mr. Duke. But since I knew the nature of your work, I thought...
I know, I said quickly.
Look, you want to be gentle with that woman if she ever calls again. She's our case study. We're watching her very carefully. I felt my head unwinding now. The words came easily. She's perfectly harmless, of course. There'll be no trouble. This woman has been into laudanum. It's a controlled experiment, but I suspect we'll need your cooperation before this thing is over.
Well, certainly, he said. We're always happy to cooperate with the police, just as long as there won't be any trouble. For us, I mean.
Don't worry, I said. You're protected. Just treat this poor woman like you'd treat any other human being in trouble.
What? He seemed to be stuttering.
Ah, yes, yes, I see what you mean, yes. So you'll be responsible then?
Of course, I said. And now I have to get back to the news.
Thank you, he muttered.
Send the ice, I said, and hung up.
My attorney was smiling peacefully at the TV set.
Good work, he said. They'll treat us like goddamn lepers after that.
I nodded, filling a tall glass with Chivas Regal.
There hasn't been any news on the tube for 3 hours, he said absently. That poor fool probably thinks we're plugged into some kind of special cop channel. You should call back and ask him to send up a 3,000-watt sensing capacitor, along with the ice. Tell him ours just burned out.
You forgot about Lucy, I said. She's looking for you.
He laughed. No, she's looking for you.
Me?
Yeah, she really flipped over you. The only way I could get rid of her out there in the airport was by saying you were taking me out to the desert for a showdown, that you wanted me out of the way so you could have her all to yourself.
He shrugged.
Shit, I had to tell her something. I said she should go back to the Americana and wait to see which one of us came back.
He laughed again.
I guess she figures you won. That phone message wasn't from me, was it?
I nodded. It made no sense at all, but I knew it was true. Drug reasoning. The rhythms were brutally clear, and to him they made excellent sense. He was slumped in the chair, concentrating on Mission Impossible. I thought for a while, then stood up and began stuffing things into my suitcase.
What are you doing? He asked.
Never mind, I said. The zipper stuck momentarily, but I yanked it shut. Then I put on my shoes.
Wait a minute, he said. Jesus, you're not leaving.
I nodded.
You're goddamn right I'm leaving. But don't worry, I'll stop at the desk on my way out. You'll be taken care of.
He stood up quickly, kicking his drink over.
Okay, goddammit, this is serious. Where's my 357?
I shrugged, not looking at him, as I crammed the Chivas Regal bottles into my hand satchel.
I sold it in Baker, I said. I owe you $35. Jesus Christ, he shouted. That thing cost me $190 goddamn.
I smiled. You told me where you got that gun, I said.
Remember?
He hesitated, pretending to think.
Oh, yeah, he said finally. Yeah. That punk out in Pasadena.
Then he flared again.
So it cost me $1,000,000. That asshole shot a narc. He was looking at life. Shit. 3 weeks in court, and all I got was a fucking six-shooter.
You're stupid, I said. I warned you about dealing with junkies on credit, especially when they're guilty.
You're lucky the bastard didn't pay you off with a bullet in the stomach. My attorney sagged. He was my cousin. The jury found him innocent. Shit, I snapped. How many people has that junkie bastard shot since we've known him? 6? 8? That evil little fuck is so guilty that I should probably kill him myself on general principles. He shot that narc just as sure as he killed that girl at the Holiday Inn, and that guy in Ventura. He eyed me coldly. You better be careful, man. You're into some heavy slander. I laughed, tossing my luggage together in a lump at the foot of the bed while I sat down to finish my drink. I actually intended to leave. I didn't really want to, but I figured that nothing I could possibly do with this gig was worth the risk of getting tangled up with Lucy. No doubt she was a beautiful person, if she ever got straight. Very sensitive, with a secret reserve of fine karma underneath her pit bull act. A great talent with fine instincts. Just a heavy little gal who unfortunately went stone crazy somewhere prior to her 18th birthday. I had nothing personal against her, but I knew she was perfectly capable under these circumstances of sending us both to prison for at least 20 years on the strength of some heinous story we would probably never even hear until she took the stand. Yes, sir, those two men over there in the dock are the ones who gave me the LSD and took me to the hotel.
And what did they do then, Lucy?
Well, sir, I can't rightly remember.
Indeed. Well, perhaps this document from the district attorney's files will refresh your memory, Lucy. This is the statement you made to Officer Squain shortly after you were found wandering naked in the desert near Lake Mead.
Lucy, why don't you read this statement to the jury?
I don't know for sure what they'd done to me, but I remember it was horrible. One guy picked me up in the Los Angeles airport. He's the one who gave me the pill. And the other one met us at the hotel. He was sweating real bad, and he talked so fast that I couldn't understand what he wanted. No, sir, I don't recall exactly what they did to me at that point, because I was still under the influence of that drug. Yes, sir, the LSD they gave me. And I think I was naked for a long time, maybe the whole time they had me there. I think it was evening. Because I remember they had the news on. Yes, sir, Walter Cronkite. I remember his face all through it.
No, I was not ready for this. No jury would doubt her testimony, especially when it came stuttering out through a fog of tears and obscene acid flashbacks. And the fact that she couldn't recall precisely what we had done to her would make it impossible to deny. The jury would know what we'd done. They would have read about people like us in the $2.95 paperbacks, up to the hilt and only skin deep, and seen our type in the $5 fuck flicks. And of course, we couldn't possibly risk taking the stand in our own defense, not after they'd cleaned out the trunk of the whale.
And I'd like to point out, Your Honor, that our prosecution exhibits A through Y are available to the jury. Yes, this incredible collection of illegal drugs and narcotics, which the defendants had in their possession at the time of their arrests and forcible seizure by no less than 9 officers, 6 of whom are still hospitalized. And also Exhibit Z, sworn testimony by 3 professional narcotics experts selected by the president of the National District Attorney's Conference, which was seriously embarrassed by the defendants' attempts to infiltrate, disrupt, and pervert their annual convention. These experts have testified that the drug cash in the possession of these defendants at the time of the arrests was enough to kill an entire platoon of United States Marines. And gentlemen, I use the word kill with all due respect, for the fear and loathing I'm sure it provokes in every one of you when you reflect that these degenerate rapists use this galaxy of narcotics to completely destroy the mind and morals of this once innocent teenager, this ruined and degraded young girl who now sits before you in shame.
Yes. They fed this girl enough drugs to scramble her brain so horribly that she can no longer even recall the filthy details of that orgy she was forced to endure. And then they used her, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, for their own unspeakable ends.
This ends Disc 3. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Disc 4.
5. A terrible experience with extremely dangerous drugs. There was no way to cope with it. I stood up and gathered my luggage. It was important, I felt, to get out of town immediately. My attorney seemed to finally grasp this. "Wait," he shouted. "You can't leave me alone in this snake pit. This room is in my name." I shrugged. "Okay, goddammit," he said, moving toward the phone. "Look, I'll call her. I'll get her off our backs." He nodded. "You're right. She's my problem." I shook my head. "No, it's gone too far." "You'd make a piss poor lawyer," he replied. "Relax, I'll handle this." He dialed the Americana and asked for 1600. "Hi, Lucy," he said. "Yeah, it's me. I got your message." "What?" "Hell no, I taught the bastard a lesson he'll never forget." "What?" "No, not dead, but he won't be bothering anybody for a while." "Yeah, I left him out there. I stomped him and pulled all his teeth out." "Jesus," I thought. "What a terrible thing to lay on somebody with a head full of acid." "But here's the problem," he was saying. "I have to leave here right away. That bastard cashed a bad check downstairs and gave you as a reference, so they'll be looking for both of you." "Yeah, I know, but you can't judge a book by its cover, Lucy. Some people are just basically rotten. Anyway, the last thing in the world you want to do is call this hotel again. They'll trace the call and put you straight behind bars." "No, I'm moving to the Tropicana right away. I'll call you from there when I know my room number." "Yeah, probably 2 hours. I have to act casual or they'll capture me, too. I think I'll probably use a different name, but I'll let you know what it is." "Sure, just as soon as I check in." "What?" "Of course, we'll go to the circus and catch the polar bear act. It'll freak you right out." He was nervously shifting the phone from ear to ear while he talked. "No, listen, I have to get off. They probably have the phone tapped." "Yeah, I know it was horrible, but it's all over now." "Oh my God, they're kicking the door down." He hurled the phone down and began shouting, "No, get away from me. I'm innocent. It was Duke. I swear to God." He kicked the phone against the wall, then leaned down to it and began yelling again. "No, I don't know where she is. I think she went back to Montana. You'll never catch Lucy. She's gone." He kicked the receiver again, then picked it up and held it about a foot away from his mouth as he uttered a long, quavering groan. "No, no, don't put that thing on me," he screamed. Then he slammed the phone down. "Well," he said quietly, "that's that. She's probably stuffing herself down the incinerator about now." He smiled. "Yeah, I think that's the last we'll be hearing from Lucy." I slumped on the bed. His performance had given me a bad jolt. For a moment, I thought his mind had snapped, that he actually believed he was being attacked by invisible enemies. But the room was quiet again. He was back in his chair watching Mission Impossible and fumbling idly with the hash pipe. It was empty. "Where's that opium?" he asked. I tossed him the kit bag. "Be careful," I muttered. "There's not much left." He chuckled. "As your attorney," he said, "I advise you not to worry." He nodded toward the bathroom. "Take a hit out of that little brown bottle in my shaving kit." "What is it?" "Adrenochrome," he said.
You won't need much, just a little tiny taste.
I got the bottle and dipped the head of a paper match into it.
That's about right, he said. That stuff makes pure mescaline seem like ginger beer. You'll go completely crazy if you take too much.
I licked the end of the match.
Where'd you get this? I asked. You can't buy it.
Never mind, he said. It's absolutely pure.
I shook my head sadly.
Jesus, what kind of monster client have you picked up this time? There's only one source for this stuff.
He nodded.
The adrenaline glands from a living human body, I said. It's no good if you get it out of a corpse.
I know, he replied. But the guy didn't have any cash. He's one of these Satanism freaks. He offered me human blood, said it would make me higher than I'd ever been in my life.
He laughed.
I thought he was kidding, so I told him I'd just as soon have an ounce or so of pure adrenochrome, or maybe just a fresh adrenaline gland to chew on.
I could already feel the stuff working on me. The first wave felt like a combination of mescaline and methadrine. Maybe I should take a swim, I thought.
Yeah, my attorney was saying. They nailed this guy for child molesting, but he swears he didn't do it. Why should I fuck with children, he says. They're too small.
He shrugged.
Christ, what could I say? Even a goddamn werewolf is entitled to legal counsel. I didn't dare turn the creep down. He might have picked up a letter opener and gone after my pineal gland.
Why not? I said. He could probably get Melvin Belli for that.
I nodded, barely able to talk now. My body felt like I'd just been wired into a 220-volt socket.
Shit, we should get us some of that stuff, I muttered finally. Just eat a big handful and see what happens.
Some of what?
Extract of pineal.
He stared at me.
Sure, he said. That's a good idea. One whiff of that shit would turn you into something out of a goddamn medical encyclopedia. Man, your head would swell up like a watermelon. You'd probably gain about 100 pounds in 2 hours. Claws, bleeding warts. Then you'd notice about 6 huge hairy tits swelling up on your back.
He shook his head emphatically.
Man, I'll try just about anything, but I'd never in hell touch a pineal gland.
Last Christmas, somebody gave me a whole Jimson weed. The root must have weighed 2 pounds, enough for a year. But I ate the whole goddamn thing in about 20 minutes.
I was leaning toward him, following his words intently. The slightest hesitation made me want to grab him by the throat and force him to talk faster.
Right, I said eagerly. Jimson weed. What happened?
Luckily, I vomited most of it right back up, he said. But even so, I went blind for 3 days. Christ, I couldn't even walk. My whole body turned to wax. I was such a mess that they had to haul me back to the ranch house in a wheelbarrow. They said I was trying to talk, but I sounded like a raccoon.
Fantastic, I said, but I could barely hear him. I was so wired that my hands were clawing uncontrollably at the bedspread, jerking it right out from under me while he talked. My heels were dug into the mattress, with both knees locked. I could feel my eyeballs swelling, about to pop out of the sockets.
Finish the fucking story, I snarled. What happened? What about the glands?
He backed away, keeping an eye on me as he edged across the room.
Maybe you need another drink, he said nervously. Jesus, that stuff got right on top of you, didn't it?
I tried to smile.
Well, nothing worse. No, this is worse.
It was hard to move my jaws. My tongue felt like burning magnesium.
No. Nothing to worry about, I hissed. Maybe if you could just shove me into the pool or something.
God damn it, he said.
You took too much. You're about to explode. Jesus, look at your face.
I couldn't move, total paralysis now. Every muscle in my body was contracted. I couldn't even move my eyeballs, much less turn my head or talk.
It won't last long, he said. The first rush is the worst. Just ride the bastard out. If I put you in the pool right now, you'd sink like a goddamn stone.
Death. I was sure of it. Not even my lungs seemed to be functioning. I needed artificial respiration, but I couldn't open my mouth to say so. I was gonna die, just sitting there on the bed, unable to move. Well, at least there's no pain. Probably I'll black out in a few seconds, and after that it won't matter. My attorney had gone back to watching television. The news was on again. Nixon's face filled the screen, but his speech was hopelessly garbled. The only word I could make out was sacrifice, over and over again. Sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. I could hear myself breathing heavily. My attorney seemed to notice.
Just stay relaxed, he said over his shoulder, without looking at me. Don't try to fight it or you'll start getting brain bubbles, strokes, aneurysms. You'll just wither up and die.
His hand snaked out to change channels. It was after midnight when I finally was able to talk and move around. But I was still not free of the drug. The voltage had merely been cranked down from 220 to 110. I was a babbling, nervous wreck, flapping around the room like a wild animal, pouring sweat and unable to concentrate on any one thought for more than 2 or 3 seconds at a time. My attorney put down the phone after making several calls.
"There's only one place where we can get fresh salmon," he said, "and it's closed on Sunday."
"Of course," I snapped. "These goddamn Jesus freaks, they're multiplying like rats." He eyed me curiously.
"What about the process?" I said. "Don't they have a place here? Maybe a delicatessen or something? With a few tables in back? They have a fantastic menu in London. I ate there once. Incredible food."
"Get a grip on yourself," he said. "You don't want to even mention the process in this town."
"You're right," I said. "Call Inspector Bloor. He knows about food. I think he has a list."
"Better to call room service," he said. "We can get the Crab Louie and a quart of Christian Brothers Muscatel for about $20.
"No," I said. "We must get out of this place. I need air. Let's drive up to Reno and get a big tuna fish salad."
"Hell, it won't take long. Only about 400 miles. No traffic out there on the desert."
"Forget it," he said. "That's army territory, bomb tests, nerve gas. We'd never make it."
We wound up at a place called the Big Flip, about halfway downtown. I had a New York steak for $1.88. My attorney ordered the Coyote Bush Basket for $2.09. And after that, we drank off a pot of watery Golden West coffee and watched four boozed-up cowboy types kick a faggot half to death between the pinball machines.
"The action never stops in this town," said my attorney, as we shuffled out to the car. "A man with the right contacts could probably pick up all the fresh adrenochrome he wanted if he hung around here for a while."
I agreed, but I wasn't quite up to it right then. I hadn't slept for something like 80 hours, and that fearful ordeal with the drug had left me completely exhausted. Tomorrow we would have to get serious. The drug conference was scheduled to kick off at noon, and we were still not sure how to handle it. So we drove back to the hotel and watched a British horror film on The Late Show. Six. Getting down to business. Opening day at the drug convention.
"On behalf of the prosecuting attorneys of this county, I welcome you."
We sat in the rear fringe of a crowd of about 1,500 in the main ballroom of the Dunes Hotel. Far up in front of the room, barely visible from the rear, the executive director of the National District Attorneys Association, a middle-aged, well-groomed, successful GOP businessman type named Patrick Healy, was opening their third national institute on narcotics and dangerous drugs. His remarks reached us by way of a big, low-fidelity speaker mounted on a steel pole in our corner. Perhaps a dozen others were spotted around the room, all facing the rear and looming over the crowd, so that no matter where you sat or even tried to hide, you were always looking down the muzzle of a big speaker. This produced an odd effect. People in each section of the ballroom tended to stare at the nearest voice box instead of watching the distant figure of whoever was actually talking far up front on the podium. This 1935 style of speaker placement totally depersonalized the room. There was something ominous and authoritarian about it. Whoever set up that sound system was probably some kind of sheriff's auxiliary technician on leave from a drive-in theater in Muskogee, Illinois, where the management couldn't afford individual car speakers and relied on 10 huge horns mounted on telephone poles in the parking area. A year or so earlier, I had been to the Sky River Rock Festival in rural Washington, where a dozen stone-broke freaks from the Seattle Liberation Front had assembled a sound system that carried every small note of an acoustic guitar, even a cough or the sound of a boot dropping on the stage, to half-deaf acid victims huddled under bushes a half-mile away. But the best technicians available to the National DA's convention in Vegas apparently couldn't handle it. Their sound system looked like something Ulysses S. Grant might have triggered up to address his troops during the siege of Vicksburg. The voices from up front crackled with a fuzzy, high-pitched urgency, and the delay was just enough to keep the words disconcertingly out of phase with the speaker's gestures. "We must come to terms with the drug culture in this country. Country. Country." These echoes drifted back to the rear in confused waves. "The reefer butt is called a roach because it resembles a cockroach. Cockroach. Cockroach." "What the fuck are these people talking about?" my attorney whispered. "You'd have to be crazy on acid to think a joint looked like a goddamn cockroach." I shrugged. It was clear that we'd stumbled into a prehistoric gathering. The voice of a drug expert named Bloomquist crackled out of the nearby speakers. "About these flashbacks, the patient never knows. He thinks it's all over and he gets himself straightened out for 6 months, and then, darn it, the whole trip comes back on him." Gosh darn that fiendish LSD. Dr. E.R. Bloomquist, M.D., was the keynote speaker, one of the big stars of the conference. He is the author of a paperback book titled Marijuana, which, according to the cover, tells it like it is. He is also the inventor of the roach-cockroach theory. According to the book jacket, he is an associate clinical professor of surgery, anesthesiology, at the University of Southern California School of Medicine, and also a well-known authority on the abuse of dangerous drugs. Dr. Bloomquist has appeared on national network television panels, has served as a consultant for government agencies, was a member of the Committee on Narcotics Addiction and Alcoholism of the Council on Mental Health of the American Medical Association. His wisdom is massively reprinted and distributed, says the publisher. He is clearly one of the heavies on that circuit of second-rate academic hustlers who get paid anywhere from $500 to $1,000 a hit for lecturing to cop crowds. Dr. Bloomquist's book is a compendium of state bullshit. On page 49, he explains the four states of being in the cannabis society: cool, groovy, hip, and square, in that descending order. "The square is seldom, if ever, cool," says Bloomquist. "He is not with it. That is, he doesn't know what's happening. But if he manages to figure it out,
He moves up a notch to hip, and if he can bring himself to approve of what's happening, he becomes groovy. And after that, with much luck and perseverance, he can rise to the rank of cool.
Bloomquist writes like somebody who once bearded Tim Leary in a campus cocktail lounge and paid for all the drinks. And it was probably somebody like Leary who told him with a straight face that sunglasses are known in the drug culture as tea shades. This is the kind of dangerous gibberish that used to be posted in the form of mimeographed bulletins in police department locker rooms. Indeed,
know your dope fiend. Your life may depend on it. You will not be able to see his eyes because of tea shades, but